Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Actually, it's not really a good afternoon. Yesterday was the one-year anniversary of October 7th on the Gregorian calendar. Now, I say that because Jewish mourning for those who have passed takes place on the anniversary of the Hebrew calendar, which would shift the date to October 24th. You won't have a public commemoration because that's also a Jewish holiday, but individual families will observe it. So we're looking at October 7th for that reason, and also because, like 9/11, October 7th has become a date that means something by itself. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Jewish calendar, you're likely to see a strong wave of public sentiment in Israel on the 24th, regardless of the holiday. So be watching both ends of this. Strong sentiment is what we're going to talk about today with our guest, Avi Meir, co-chair of the Advisory Board of Global Jewry and immediate past editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Israelis are dealing with tragic losses, the continuing plight of the hostages in Gaza, a horrific barrage of rockets from Iran, the ensuing wars to protect and defend Israel from Iran and its proxies, and the IDF casualties this has engendered. Israeli society has been stressed almost beyond measure. But in the 2024 world ranking of the happiest countries, Israel still ranked fifth. Among young people, it's second. I'm not sure how that's possible, but I think that's what we're going to talk about. Before we go to Avi, your JPC commercial. The Jewish Policy Center was established in 1985 as a nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policies. We support strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, which appears to have been back-pocketed for the moment, and missile defense. Most important today, we support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the efforts of the government of Israel and the IDF to defend the people of Israel on all of its borders and beyond those borders. And we support justice in Gaza, meaning the return of the hostages and the wresting of political as well as military power from Hamas. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can read our insight articles, in context articles, and the new issue of our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. You can also watch previous issues of our webinar series. And now our guest. Avi Meir is former editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. He is now a member of the Advisory Board of Global Jewry. Now, I admit I didn't know the organization, so I looked it up. Its mission, it says, is, and here I quote, to create a global platform where Jews of all ages, all backgrounds, and all perspectives can join together in a welcoming and respectful environment to celebrate our shared values, explore our shared history, and chart our shared future. I love it. I love it. I think we need it. I think Jews need it. I think Americans need it. I think everybody needs it. Avi has also been the international spokesperson of the Jewish Agency for Israel, managing director of global communications and public affairs at the HAC, and spent time on Capitol Hill, the Israeli embassy, Hillel International, and the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. He knows a lot about what Jews think and about what Israelis think. I strongly recommend his X feed at Avi Meir. He's only got 286,000 followers, so I figured I would help him boost that up a little bit, and later he can boost the JPC. Avi, I would normally turn the mic over to you at this point, but I want to start you with a thought. In the summer of 2023, there were large-scale demonstrations in Israel over judicial reform and the recommended and the Haredi draft exemption. Some military officers recommended that reservists not report for duty. And people were predicting real civil unrest, riots, rather than demonstrations. So did October 7th cause a realignment? And if it did, and it seems to have, is that temporary or long-term? Is it a question of priorities? Fight the armed enemy now and fight your politically difficult neighbors later. Now, Avi Meir, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana, for that very generous introduction, and thank you to the JPC for hosting this event today. I thought I'd start with a few words of introduction, and then Shoshana, I think you and I will engage in conversation, and we'll open it up to Q&A with the audience. You're exactly right that just over a year ago, it felt as though this country was coming apart at the seams. I came into the Jerusalem Post not that long beforehand, about half a year, three quarters of a year before the start of this war. And at the time, the main topic of conversation in this country was the government's judicial reform and the intense opposition to it. And it really felt as though we were at the brink of some kind of dissolution, perhaps even of the Jewish state. It got to the point where there were actual articles that appeared in mainstream publications asking whether this was the end of Israel. And we, of course, as a responsible publication, brought perspectives from across this debate. We offered the Prime Minister himself a platform. He granted us his first interview since taking office, which I conducted together with a colleague, in which he spoke about the justification for this judicial reform. And of course, we offered his opponents a platform as well. And it was an extremely intense debate that seemed to cause all sorts of latent fissures within Israeli society to bubble to the surface. Fissures between right and left-wing Israelis, between religious and secular, Jewish and non-Jewish. And it felt like this was something that could very well tear the country apart. And I remember, I'm sure many of you do as well, that just over 1 week before October 7th, there were literal fistfights in the streets of Tel Aviv over the question of whether or not there could be a separation between genders at Yom Kippur services in Dizengoff Square. And then October 7th happened, and we've never been quite the same. October 7th caught me in bed. I had neglected to set my alarm for Simchat Torah holiday services at my local synagogue here in Jerusalem, and I was enjoying a few extra minutes sleep when I was roused from my sleep by the sound of an air raid siren. I remember sitting upright and sort of tilting my head to the window and wondering in my half-awake state whether that was indeed what I was hearing. Of course, upon confirming that it was, I jumped out of bed. My sister was spending the holiday weekend with me. I grabbed her off my pull-out sofa and we huddled in a corner of my apartment that I surmised was furthest from the windows in case there was a blast outside and shards would be coming our way. And then the sirens died down and I found myself confronted with a dilemma. I am a Shabbat observant. I don't generally use my phone or other electronic devices on Shabbat or Jewish holidays. But as the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, I felt like I should have some awareness of what was going on because even then I sensed that something unusual was happening. And so I decided to turn on my phone. And at the time, all we knew was that there was a heavy barrage of rockets flying into Israel from Gaza, targeting mostly southern Israeli communities, but going as far as Tel Aviv and, of course, here in Jerusalem. And then I found myself confronted with another question: do I still go to Shabbat morning services? It was, as mentioned, a holiday weekend. We were anticipating many, many dozens of families and children. It's generally a very family and child-oriented holiday. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go to synagogue, but I'm going to bring my phone with me. And I discreetly slipped it in my pocket. And what I then experienced that morning was a surreal prayer service where every 20 minutes or so, we would have to cover the Torah and go down to our bomb shelter because the sirens would be starting anew as rockets flew in from Gaza. And every 10 minutes or so, I would discreetly step out of the room to communicate with my team and make sure that we were covering the events in the ground as on the ground as they developed. And I remember the first notification that popped up on my screen informing me and the rest of the audience that 10 people had been killed. I remember looking at my screen and wondering, 10 people were killed by what? We have this incredible technological marvel in the form of the Iron Dome that shoots these rockets out of the sky. It's extraordinarily rare that anyone is killed by rockets from Gaza, thankfully, and I couldn't fathom what 10 people had been killed by. It just didn't make any sense. And then slowly 10 became 20 and 20 became 30 and 30 became 50. And the numbers just kept mounting. We still had no idea. The fog was still so heavy. We had absolutely no idea what was actually happening on the ground. Until some point in the service, when I received a notification with an Israeli official confirming that several communities in southern Israel were now being held by Hamas. I remember this pit developing immediately in my stomach and the shiver running down my spine as it dawned on me what we were in fact facing that day. And we wrapped up the service as quickly as we possibly could. I went back home, and at that point, the holiday was essentially canceled. I started working full time, communicating with our reporting team. I set up a little broadcast studio in my backyard and started doing back-to-back interviews with international media networks. And that sort of set the pace for the initial period of the war. And, we, of course, have been hardest hit here in Israel. Of course, the 1,200 families who lost loved ones that day and the hundreds who have lost loved ones in the war since, the families of the 250 hostages who, of course, have been racked with anxiety for various periods of time. There's still 101 hostages who are being held unfathomably in Gaza, entering their second year of captivity, and it truly defies comprehension. The tens of thousands of Israeli families who have been displaced from their homes, many of whom don't have homes to go back to because they've been destroyed by Hezbollah in the north and have no idea where they will live in the future. The thousands upon thousands of families grappling with all sorts of loss, injuries, mental health conditions, businesses that have collapsed. And even so, we've also been keenly aware of the challenges being encountered by Jewish communities around the world. That the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust should have precipitated not an unprecedented wave of sympathy with Jews, but rather the worst wave of anti-Semitism that any of us have ever seen also defies comprehension. And yet, that is exactly what we have been encountering on college campuses, in city streets, on social media, and around the world. And it's felt like a very hopeless year, I think, for many of us. We have been confronted with realities that we either didn't know existed or had preferred to ignore for a very long time and simply can ignore no longer. The reality that there are people amongst us, not only over the border, but sometimes next to us at the cash register, at the supermarket, or taking classes with us in college, who really don't want us to exist at all, who say so very openly, who march in city streets trumpeting the victory, the glorious victory of Hamas on October the 7th, and who hail the resistance ever since. The reality that there are people who will put effect to that desire by slaughtering us wholesale, by coming over the border and kidnapping children and executing elderly people in the street. And the reality that at the end of the day, kind words aside, much of the world will stand by as that happens and won't lift a finger in our defense. And so it's been extremely dispiriting, I think, in many ways for so many of us here in Israel and around the world over the past year. And we were reminded of that, of course, yesterday on the 1 year anniversary. But I would say that there have also been small points of light that have buttressed us and enabled us to make it through this extremely, extremely difficult past year. And the first one I'll mention is the tremendous sense of unity that we experienced in this country in the immediate aftermath of the October 7th attack. A country that was seemingly coming apart at the seams came together as nothing I'd ever experienced before. All those groups I mentioned earlier that had been pitted against one another coalesced as one to support the families of the victims and the hostages, the displaced people who had been kicked out of their homes, and everyone who had been most detrimentally affected by the war on the ground. You had non-kosher restaurants in Tel Aviv making their kitchens kosher so that they could send meals to the soldiers on the front lines. You had Haredi Israelis going through accelerated basic training programs that they could participate in the war effort in some way. You had Arab citizens of Israel saying they felt more Israeli today than they ever had before. And that sense of unity, I think, is in large part what carried us through that initial period, that immediate trauma that we were all feeling so very much. And I think it really helped us in the initial part of the war. I think another thing that has lifted our spirits and carried us through has been the sense of solidarity and support that we've encountered from Jews around the world and other supporters. I can't tell you how many WhatsApp messages and social media direct messages I've received, little heart emojis, people who just want to reach out and say that they understand I'm going through something challenging, that my people are going through something they don't quite understand, but they just want me and my people to know that they're thinking of us. And the rallies that we've seen, the advocacy in which Jews and non-Jews have engaged over the past year in Israel's support to ensure that their governments support Israel's right to defend itself, all of it has been extremely heartwarming and has given us a sense that ultimately we're not alone. And we do have friends and supporters and lovers around the world who will ensure that they have our back when we really need it in our time of need. And then there is one last thing that actually caught me somewhat unawares. And I say that as a bit of a mea culpa. I feel like I should have noticed it sooner than I did. But it took a question I received while speaking to a group, I think it was from Dallas, Texas. I had spoken to this delegation who was visiting one of these solidarity missions, of which there have been very many over the past year. And this gentleman raised his hand and said, "Do you feel that this is the end of Zionism?" And I looked at him, I said, I'm not sure I understand the question. Can you explain what it is that you're talking about?" He said, "Well, don't you feel that young Israelis will look at the events of October 7th and the months since and say, you know what? We simply have no future in this place. We cannot raise our children in a reality in which the hordes can just come through the border at any time, slaughter us, and take our children captive. Do you feel that this will simply mean the end of Zionism, that Jews, young people in this country will simply leave, that they have no future here?" And it took me a second to sort of internalize what this person was asking. And I said, "No, I don't feel this is the end of Zionism. I actually feel that this is a revitalization of Zionism." And as I think back over the events of the past year and the period immediately beforehand, I realized that this is not something that started on October 7th. It's actually something that started last summer when hundreds upon thousands of Israelis poured into the streets of Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and other cities, fighting in favor or against the government's judicial reform. And I can tell you, my office at the Jerusalem Post at the time was on Jaffa Road, which of course is a major thoroughfare in Jerusalem, and many of the protesters, both in favor and against the government's judicial reform, would go past our office windows. And I could not tell you who was who, because they were all waving Israeli flags and chanting slogans calling for a better future. And what was so striking about it is that so many of these young people were residents of Tel Aviv, quote unquote, Tel Avivim, who we had been told to discount entirely. We had been told for years that these were young people who had no interest in the future of Israel, that all they wanted was to take out a European passport, move to Berlin, get a tech job, and leave this land behind. And yet there they were every single Saturday night fighting for their vision of a better future for this land. And then after October 7th, those same young people, many of whom were traveling the world, it was a holiday period, packed onto El Al J planes, slept on the floors of jets in order to rejoin their army units and fight and sometimes die for this country. And the wave of volunteerism, the giving that we have seen over the past year, has been incredibly inspiring. And I find myself more hopeful about the future of Israel after October 7th than I ever was before. And I think this is something that many of us are feeling, both in Israel and around the world. I can tell you that I've been back to the States more than half a dozen times over the past year. And each time I meet with young people, with college students who are encountering some of the most vicious, vitriolic hatred of Israel and of Jews on their college campuses, I emerge inspired anew because these are young people who have been doubling down on their Jewish identity, who say, "You're not going to push me off of my college campus. I have every right to be here as a proud and open Jew and supporter of Israel." And we have a great deal of which to be proud when it comes to young people, both in Israel and around the world. And so, as I look back at the past year and I think about what it is that holds us together as a nation, I feel that we are a nation with a mission. There is something that holds us together that goes beyond our basic existence as individuals and transcends it to the point of our existence as a people. And quite frankly, I find myself pitying those societies that don't have that don't have the kind of glue that holds this nation together at times of peace and at times of war, at times of celebration, at times of pain. And I feel that that is what has us consistently posted as one of the happiest countries in the world, with the happiest societies in the world, which sounds completely insane when you consider everything we've gone through, and yet is consistently true. When you talk about the quality of life here, how people are still flocking to this land, I have a number of friends who have made Aliyah, immigrated to this country just over the past few months, who have had their first experiences of having to huddle in bomb shelters with their families just last week as Iran lobbed 200 missiles at Israel, and who say, "I still can't imagine raising my kids anywhere else." And I have to say, I don't have kids yet, which of course is a matter for my mother to bemoan, but I also can't imagine raising my children anywhere else. This is our home, and I can't imagine not being here. I can't imagine not giving my children that sense of belonging and that sense of being a part of something bigger than oneself that I think so many of us experience here in Israel that makes us such a special, meaningful, and ultimately happy place to be. So I'm going to pause there, and I'm happy to take whatever questions, Shoshana, you have, and then I'm happy to engage the audience as well.
So I have questions, but I have to say that people who watch this program regularly know that my goal is to ask a question at the end of the program, the answer to which is a positive. But you've already given us the positive answer to the question I haven't asked yet. So I'll have to work on that as we speak. But there are a lot of other things to talk about. A lot of people on the political left, both in the United States and in Israel, have made Prime Minister Netanyahu the villain in the current war. They accuse him of blocking a deal. They claim to see a distinction between the elected leader of Israel and the people of Israel. And yet, no less an opponent of Bibi on many things than Benny Gantz just wrote an op-ed in the New York Times endorsing Netanyahu's efforts to challenge Iran and its terrorist proxies. So, the question is, what does public support for the prime minister actually look like? And is it because there's support for an all-out military campaign? And so could that fade later? I mean, where is, excuse me, where is the prime minister and where is public opinion in this?
So it's important to note that the prime minister was deeply unpopular before this war, largely because of the debate surrounding the judicial reform, which, of course, as I said, was viewed as having torn this country apart. And his approval ratings suffered further during the initial part of the war, although I would say that they have recovered somewhat. It's important to realize that while there is certainly a distinction between a government and the people of a country, there is widespread, I would say, wall-to-wall support for the war effort in this country and has been since the first day. And I find it rather funny when I read statements by certain politicians in America referring to this as Netanyahu's war or Netanyahu's campaign against the people of Gaza. This is not something that is unique to Netanyahu. And as you said, the fact that Benny Gantz himself was a part of the governing coalition for a period of time should serve as an indication that there is extremely strong support in this country for the military effort to decimate Hamas's military capability, to ensure that the residents of the South and now of the North have peace and calm and can return to their homes. and to have those hostages brought back. And those goals have long been viewed as complementary. I will say that over the past few months, there have developed two opposing camps in Israel that view the continuation of the war and the return of the hostages as being in opposition to one another. And they have fallen, not exactly, but roughly along the same lines as the two camps that had been warring against one another before October 7th. And it has largely centered on the personality of Benjamin Netanyahu himself. Whether you support him or oppose him has largely determined where you sort of stand in either camp. And it is an extremely painful debate in this country. I don't think there are many Israelis who would say that they don't want Hamas decimated. I don't think there are many Israelis who would say they don't want the hostages brought back home. But there was a realization that one may, at this point, have to come at the expense of the other. And the question at this point is where do you draw that line? And at what point do you make a call about which is the more immediately important priority? And that is something that we've been grappling with. It's something that has largely fallen to the sidelines over the past few weeks as the campaign against Hezbollah and now Iran has intensified, but it's still very present in our minds. We're still keenly aware of the fact that there are 101 hostages languishing under God knows what conditions. We don't even know how many of them are still alive in Gaza. And so the debate around their fate and how to best bring them home has animated the Israeli political scene and has again sort of centered on the prime minister and his leadership and whether it is well suited to the matter at hand.
So this brings up the kind of larger question of hostages. The US clearly wants Israel to pay a price and want to figure out the price and pay it and do what you can do. But what about the repercussions of Israel's experiences in this area? There was the Gilad Shalit deal, and while nobody can blame Shalit for what happened after he was rescued, the Israeli government paid a huge price for him, including the release of Ahlam Tamimi and Yahya Sinwar. Does ransoming hostages ensure more hostages? And is that a key part of the conversation that's going on in Israel? We give something for the present, and do we thereby risk people in the future? And whose children will those be?
I think that is very much the crux of the issue. I think you have very well identified the main dilemma facing Israeli decision makers at this moment. And I have to say that I have had a pretty nuanced view of this from the start. I've gone on CNN and the BBC and I've defended the prime minister and I've said, look, there are serious security concerns. And there are. It's undeniable that if you release thousands upon thousands of convicted Palestinian terrorists, that some percentage of them, perhaps most, maybe even all, will return to the circle of terror. And likely Yahya Sinwar could play a key role in perpetrating future massacres and future atrocities against the people of Israel. I would say that on a personal level, the recovery of the six bodies of the hostages who were murdered by Hamas just a few weeks ago, including that of Hirsch Goldberg Polan, whose parents I've come to know personally, has tilted the scales for me. And I feel that at this point, there's almost no price too high to pay to just bring as many hostages as we possibly can back home, and we will deal with the ramifications afterwards. And I know that that in light of everything I just said, may come off as irresponsible, as disregarding future security concerns for the present. But when I think about the fact that there are 101 people in Gaza, including small children and elderly people, and their family members back home who don't know whether they're alive or dead, I cannot think of anything that is more urgent or more important than getting as many of them home right now as you possibly can. And I can tell you from having spoken to many other Israelis that they have come to that realization as well over the past few weeks. Now, that doesn't mean that we can sign an agreement tomorrow. We know that Hamas has consistently been the primary obstacle to any kind of a deal And Rabin, so today, the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, and other officials have said so that, frustrated as they may be with the Prime Minister and his leadership and so on, it has been Hamas that has consistently been the primary obstacle to a deal. And we're not even sure whether they're serious about getting one. I've heard estimates over the past few days that we should forget about it. They're actually not ever going to sign such a deal. But so long as there is even a sliver of hope that we could somehow bring those hostages home, I can't imagine a high speed a price being too high to pay in order to make that happen.
So, is this the difference between bring them home and send them home? I am wearing my hostage tag, but I don't like the message which says bring them home because that puts the burden on the Israeli government to bring them home. It seems to me that the hostage tag should have said send them home, which puts the burden on Hamas. Now, if Hamas thinks that they don't have to, that Israelis will create the pressure on the Israeli government to bring instead of Hamas to send, there's no price. There's no conceivable price. How do you deal with that thought?
Look, Hamas is extremely astute. Yahya Sinwar himself, having spent time in Israeli prisons, knows Israeli society extremely well. And they know what our pressure points are and what our sensitivities are. They know the tremendously high value we see in human life, which of course is opposed to the complete degradation of human life that they perpetuate in Gaza. Yeah, they've been playing that beautifully. I do think that there is an argument to be made that these protests for the hostages and to apply pressure on the Israeli government may be viewed in Gaza with some degree of glee, that Israelis are doing Hamas's job for it, in pressuring the Israeli government to concede whatever it needs to and to do whatever it can to bring those hostages home. I 100% get that, and I've expressed that view as well. And yet I just can't get past the reality of 101 hostages languishing underground, our brothers and sisters and children and grandparents, who just need to be brought home. And so yes, I agree with you. The slogan perhaps should be more accurately rendered as send them back home or release them or free our people. And I've heard various versions of that. To me, it's not so much the message, but rather what it conveys, which is our fervent desire to see these 101 people brought home in whatever condition, as swiftly as they possibly can.
So the United States has announced a lot of money for the Palestinians, some hundreds of millions of dollars. And they built the Gaza Pier for 230 million US taxpayer dollars. Is this, in your view, a way to get Hamas to agree? Because ultimately, if Israel is unable to take Hamas out in a governing sense, I mean, militarily, I suspect the IDF has done most of its job, not all of it, but an awful lot of it. Is it wrong of the United States to be offering all this money, or are we just giving them the money with no strings?
Well, look, I think that there's an undeniable humanitarian plight in Gaza. You see the images of destruction, of displacement, of suffering in Gaza. And I think it would take a particularly callous heart to not feel some degree of sympathy for the innocent people over there. The question is, how do you best serve their needs? And I think that for too long, we have channeled government funds, not only in the United States, but around the world, through such deeply toxic organizations like UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, the Palestinian, the UN's Palestinian agency, that has served to only perpetuate the problem, that has seen numerous employees of its own engaged in the atrocities of October the 7th. Holding hostages in their homes, celebrating the October 7th massacre. I mean, the revelations have come one after the other. And I think the Biden administration and other governments did the right thing by suspending funding to UNRWA while those investigations were ongoing. I find it deeply unfortunate that several of those governments have now restored funding to UNRWA. despite the fact these revelations have been largely confirmed. I think that there's an urgent need to find channels to fund and support the people of Gaza without funding the government of Gaza, which of course is Hamas. But we know that that is extraordinarily difficult because anytime humanitarian aid is sent into Gaza, it is hijacked, it is seized by Hamas authorities, and then either used for its own purposes or sold at a tremendous markup to the people of Gaza who are suffering enough already. I don't have the easy answer. I know that there have been other situations like this in the past where the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and other humanitarian agencies in the UN have played a key role. But I know that whatever we have been doing up until this point has not been working. And so I think that the creative thought thinking that's going on in organizations like UN Watch and others trying to figure out a better solution to serve the needs of the Palestinian people is the kind of thinking we should be encouraging at this time.
So this goes right to the question of how the Israeli public feels about international community and international organizations. And yes, there is UN Watch and there are some really great organizations out there. But the UN's response itself has been extraordinarily anti-Israel. First of all, I mean, I can't really ask you to account for that because I'm not sure there's any accounting for that. But as you go forward, looking at the international community and looking at countries like France and the UK, which are theoretically friends of Israel, allies of Israel, what is Israel going to say? I mean, what do you do with Qatar? Qatar had very correct and proper relations with the government of Israel as it poured all that money in there to all the wrong people. Where do you go in the international community now?
Well, look, I think Israelis have not thought particularly highly of what we refer to as the international community for a very long time. We know that we will never get a fair shake at the United Nations and at its various different agencies and bodies. We know that there's a built-in anti-Israel majority and always has been, may always that may always be. At the same time, I think we've been extremely gratified by the support of many of our allies around the world, particularly in the immediate aftermath of October 7th. The fact that the president traveled here just 1 week into the war to show his sympathy and support for Israel, the fact that he gave Israel the support it needed, sent carrier groups to the Eastern Mediterranean to deter Iran from becoming involved. I think all of that was deeply appreciated by the people of Israel, and other expressions of solidarity and support by other world leaders were also very warmly received. Over the past few months, though, we've seen some of that support diminish, and the tone of the conversation change somewhat. So even as certain world leaders, possibly including the President of the United States, profess support for Israel's right to defend itself, it feels as though much of the onus for the continuation of the hostilities has been put on Israel. And that is not appreciated by Israelis, to say the least. We know Hamas. We know the pressure that we have been under. We know the reality on the ground. I don't think there's a single Israeli, I don't know any, at least myself, who wants this war to continue. A year in, the fact that so many young people have spent months upon months in reserve duty, placing their lives on the line, paralyzing families, companies, businesses, entire society in some ways, is deeply painful and difficult for so many Israelis, and all we want is for this war to end. But we can't just end it willy-nilly. We know that keeping Hamas in charge in Gaza is a huge risk. We know that keeping 101 hostages there is something that is intolerable. We know that so long as Hamas, Hezbollah, and other proxy groups in the region pose a threat, our children will not be able to sleep safely at night. And so we certainly don't want this war to continue, but the notion that it's somehow Israel's fault that the war is ongoing simply flies in the face of reality. We know that it is Hamas that launched this war. We know it's Hamas that has perpetuated this war. We know that it is Hamas that has rained suffering and pain on both sides of the border. Not a single Palestinian or Israeli would be dead today were it not for Hamas's decision to launch this war and keep it going for the past year. And yet, somehow Israel has been portrayed as the party that's responsible for the continuation of hostilities when we know, and I think to some degree, these leaders themselves also know that that's not the case. I think many of us have felt, particularly over the past few months, that some of the criticism, some measure of the criticism is meant to serve internal domestic political needs. Without getting into the specifics of certain states, we know where opposition to Israel lies, and it feels to many Israelis like some of the criticism to which we've been subjected in recent months has been meant particularly for those audiences. And I can tell you that Israelis are concerned about what might happen with a future administration. I can't say Israelis are particularly enthusiastic about either candidate for the presidency. They view President Trump, despite his friendliness in his first term, as unreliable and tempestuous. We don't know exactly what way he will go at any given moment and how he might choose to view Israel. And we also look at Vice President Biden, Harris, and we look at her advisors. We look at the people who have surrounded her, who are supporting her, and that gives us tremendous pause as well. So we're not, of course, sure what's going to happen after the election, and we're not sure what the future administration will look like. But I think the sum total of everything I've just said is that Israelis generally feel that while we should certainly cultivate diplomatic ties and goodwill amongst governments and nations around the world, we should do whatever we can to explain our position and our rationale for engaging in this warfare. Ultimately, we can only rely on ourselves. And I think that that is a lesson that we have received loud and clear over the past year, that at the end of the day, the only people who will really be there for us are us. And I think that that is something that we have internalized and something that will largely determine how we think about conflicts in the future.
So, relying on Israel and Israelis to take care of Israelis has a great ring to it. But if you look at the biggest issue, I think that requires looking at twice. And the biggest issue is not actually Hamas, and it's not Hezbollah, and it's not Iraqi militias. It is Iran. So there have been reports that Iranian officials, like Khamenei, in fact, have gone underground in the wake of Nasrallah's demise. What do Israelis think? I'm going to ask you two questions in one here. What do Israelis think of the idea of targeting senior regime officials? The attack against Hezbollah officials was met, I think, with joy and happiness and glee, but also partly because it went straight for those people and not the Lebanese people and not, anyone who thinks that Israel is gratuitously targeting civilians had to have learned a lesson from that. But secondly, what do Israelis think about the idea of a strike on Iran's nuclear capability? Naftali Bennett has called for that. How does that go over with the people? Does this war have to go to Iran ultimately to be ended?
I think there's a broad recognition in Israeli society that Iran represents, in the words of Naftali Bennett, the head of the octopus, that everything else, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, these militias in Iraq, they're all tentacles of an octopus whose head lives in Tehran. And there's an understanding that until you address Iran, until you confront it head on, this will likely continue in some form ad infinitum. And so I think there's broad support in Israel for dealing the Iranian regime a blow. The question is, what does that look like? I haven't seen specific polling about this measure or that, but I would say that there's been quite a lot of conversation in recent days about this being a moment in which Israel could have the international legitimacy to, for example, hit Iran's nuclear facilities or its oil refineries. That would, of course, deal Iran a tremendous, tremendous blow. In terms of regime change or targeting regime leaders, I think that Israelis are modest enough to acknowledge that they don't have the capacity to, in and of themselves, bring down the Iranian regime bring about a flowering of Iranian democracy. But perhaps if there is a sufficient blow dealt to this regime, that may inspire the Iranian people to finally rise up against their oppressive rulers and those that have kept them suppressed for so very long. And I think that there are many Israelis who feel that this is that moment. They acknowledge that any Iranian response is likely to be deeply painful. Whether or not Iran has nuclear weapons right now, they certainly have a formidable conventional force. And of course, these militias that have surrounded Israel with what is referred to as a ring of fire. And it is not unlikely that Israeli civilians will bear the brunt of a forceful Iranian response to whatever it is that Israel chooses to do. And yet, I think there are many Israelis who feel that this confrontation is going to happen at some point, whether it's now or 5 years from now. Now we have the international legitimacy. We've been subjected to an unprecedented assault in the form of 200 ballistic missiles that have exploded across the country very vividly. It's been documented in many different places. And that if there's a moment to strike Iran, it is now.
Do you think you'd have support from the United States government? And that is not a political question. I have to say, somebody just sent me a note and said I should have cut you off when you were talking about Trump and Harris. We don't do politics, which is why I didn't say anything. But without being political, if Israel finds this to be the moment that it has to happen, and if Israel believes that it has to do for itself and its people what it has to do, do you think ultimately the American government will support you?
Well, I should note that I did not and would not tell you where I stand on domestic American politics.
Thank you.
I was simply describing how Israelis view the current race. I think that there is a general understanding that America, and by the way, not only America, but also other moderate regimes in the Middle East and many other democracies around the world, would ultimately applaud Israel for dealing Iran a severe blow. But what we've heard in recent days is that American officials have conveyed to their Israeli counterparts that they shouldn't expect the United States to become directly involved in any direct strike on Iran. Now, whether that remains true should things escalate further, should there be all-out war between Israel and Iran, I don't know. I would like to think that the United States would come to the aid of such a critical ally as the State of Israel. But it has long been Israel's doctrine not to rely on the United States or any other country for its own defense. And so, if Israel does choose to embark on a severe, strong response to Iran's assault last week and to its ongoing campaign of terror and violence over the past year and for decades before, Israeli leaders will have done so understanding that ultimately, they'll have to rely solely on their own firepower, and they won't be able to rely on the United States or any other country to come to Israel's aid.
So I spent years of my professional life writing about U.S.-Israel security cooperation, Israel's ascension to CENTCOM, the things that the United States and Israel did together, planning and hoping and working to secure the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, and if necessary, deal with the problem of Iran. Is that gone? I mean, you used to have French, you had German airplanes flying over Israel, and it always kind of constricted my heart to think of the Luftwaffe flying over Israel. But as a friend, but as a friend. And the UAE took part in those. Is that over?
I don't think it's over. I think that we have seen since the start of this war some of that cooperation muted and perhaps not publicized as it has been in the past. And certainly, Israel is not in a position to, for example, engage in multilateral aerial exercises as it has in the past and other command and control scenario testing as it has in the past with other friendly militaries. But I don't think that it's gone away. I think we saw, for example, during Iran's missile assault in April, that there was actually a very impressive coalition that developed, including both the countries that you mentioned and others that helped Israel fend off that assault, and may, in fact, mobilize to intercept future assaults on the State of Israel. Ultimately, even with the challenging scenario that we're in right now and the difficult public sentiment that exists in many countries, there's an acknowledgement by the leaders of the countries that we're talking about that they stand to gain far more from an alliance with Israel than from standing in opposition to her. And that is certainly true of moderate regimes in the Middle East who view Iran as a deeply toxic and dangerous foe and acknowledge that the only power in the region with the capacity to stand up to Iran is Israel. And so I don't think it's out of a great love for the state of Israel. I don't think we're going to start seeing Israeli leaders planting trees in JNF forests and joining Hadassah. But I think there's an acknowledgement that when it comes down to raw interests, they need to align themselves with Israel and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future.
So now we've come to that point in the program. We're coming to the end, and I have to ask you, I have to find a question, the answer to which is positive. Now, you've actually given us a lot of positive stuff today, which I appreciate. But I think you just hit on another one that's important, and that is essentially the Abraham Accords, is what you're talking about. Those countries of the region that may or may not love Israel, they're not Zionists, but they have a sense of the future and security and interests that mirror those of the state of Israel. So, if you had to leave us with an optimistic thought, not only the Abraham Accords countries, but you have to include in that Egypt, which has been less than a sterling peace partner, Jordan, which has been less than a sterling peace partner. How do you see the future of countries that think like you do in many ways, but may or may not be able to express it? And by the way, you can even extend that thought and ask yourself whether there are Palestinians in Gaza or Lebanese people in Lebanon or Iranian people in Iran or Iraqi people in Iraq who also think that way and who would find it sort of liberating not to have to work under Iran's ring of fire, as you say. So give us the good news.
Hamas has said very openly that one of its goals in launching the massacre of October 7th was to thwart the coming peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And there are those who would argue that they've been somewhat successful in that. That's not something that we're talking about right now. It's not something that, as opposed to a year ago, feels like it's immediately imminent and it might happen in a matter of months, if not weeks. But I think that once things die down, you will see the realignment that had been in process before October 7th return. I think that Israel's image and perceptions of Israel were damaged by October 7th. Those who had viewed Israel as somehow invincible and capable of fending off any foe found themselves thinking twice in the immediate aftermath of October 7th. How could this military superpower be caught so completely unawares? How is it that 6,000 people could break through this fence with motorcycles and pickup trucks and engage in wholesale slaughter and the abduction of 250 innocent people? But I think that what you've seen over the past year as Israel has been bringing its military weight to bear in Gaza, the remarkable firepower that it has unleashed, not only in Gaza, but now in Lebanon and elsewhere, the stunning military achievements against Hezbollah in Lebanon, without even talking about certain operations that are attributed to Israel. Israel has acknowledged that it took out Nasrallah. It has essentially wiped out the entire leadership of Hezbollah. I think there are many Arab countries that are saying, you know what? Israel still got it. And I think that at the end of the day, interests are ironclad. They may shift somewhat, but ultimately, many of these regimes are keeping their eye on the prize being keeping Iran in check. And they acknowledge that there is no better ally in that effort than the state of Israel. The fact that you have had these countries where again, public sentiment has been problematic over the past year, maintain ties with Israel. They haven't severed ties. The fact that is Emirati Airlines, Emirates, and Fly Dubai and Etihad have flown to Israel consistently throughout this war, while European and, by the way, American Airlines have canceled their flights over the past year is an indication that they see value in maintaining this relationship through thick and thin. And I think that once the war does die down, and once we see a conclusion to those hostilities, the track that we had been on for greater normalization and acceptance for Israel amongst the Arabs, the Arab regions in this part of the world, will continue anew. And we are, I think, bound for a very bright future indeed.
You did it. You gave us an optimistic place in which I can say, Avi Meir, thank you. It's very enlightening because our media in general is it's slanted, but it's also constricted and it doesn't give you a very big picture, especially not a big picture of what's going on in Israel among the people and how they see the world. So thank you for helping us get a broader picture and an optimistic picture. And I hope we'll have you again. Thank you,
With
Avi.
pleasure. Thank you for having me.